Test 1, 2.
Thank you.
How about that? First day troubles, I guess.
It's okay. Everything's set for the recording, right? Can you just check and make sure? Because there are about 20% of the people are not here because of the snowstorm. So I checked with Ben this morning, so he said it was okay. So
yeah, I'll check it again. Watch it start and we'll make sure it looks good. Okay. But yeah, we're going to have snow problems for like another couple of days. What a way to start the year.
Yeah. Thank you. Take a few of these back to the back so that people coming in late don't have to walk all the way to the front and embarrass themselves. That's the syllabus and that's the project. So. There are two of them, so I'll put two different stacks. Okay, thank you. Okay, folks. Let's make sure you're in the right class. This is corporate finance. Is that what you're supposed to be here for? Okay, so I don't get to do this that often, teach an undergraduate class. In 31 years, I have taught 3 undergraduate classes once every decade. So this is my once in a decade. It's not because I don't want to teach you guys. The last time I taught, I had a blast, and I will have a blast this time, too, whether you want to join in or not. But last time I taught this class, I renamed it because they gave me this class that was essentially corporate finance. They called it something else, and I said, I'm not going to call it whatever you want. I'm going to call it corporate finance. So since then, they've renamed it. But this is actually a class that's going to happen in parallel with the MBAs. They start next week. Why? Because we charge them more and they get to spend fewer sessions. That's one of the things. That's one of the ways we as a school make money is we knock weeks off the semester and we charge you a little more. I know how we get away with it, partly because you let us get away with it. But that class is going to start a week from today. It's going to be 26 sessions, but each session is going to be 5 minutes longer. So I'm going to let you know a little secret. It's the same class that I will teach to both. You're saying, but we're undergraduates. No pathetic, I'm just an undergraduate stuff. I'm going to treat you like a grown-up. You're smart enough to deal with what the MBAs do. So you're going to get exactly the same class because I teach exactly the same class. If you don't like it, take a different class. Okay? So this is a class that is a corporate finance class. It's a class I've taught for 31 years. Actually, 31 years at Stern and 2 years before that at UC Berkeley. So it's 33 years of teaching the same thing over and over and over. But I'm not bored, so that's the good news. So let me let you in on a couple of things. One is I've had an incredibly large number of neurotic people emailing me over the weekend, asking me what will happen if you miss the first class. I don't know what the other professors do in the first class, but nothing's going to happen. This is not, I have 27 more sessions to get to you. So it's okay. This is really not at you. The class is being recorded for those neurotic people. They can't wait for this class to be online so they can watch me say this. So I'm saying, you're going to be okay. Whether you get back on Wednesday or Thursday or Friday or next week or 2 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, or 6 weeks from now, 15 weeks from now, you could probably take the whole class from Beijing or Mumbai for all I care. So I'm going to treat you like grown-ups with all the pluses and minuses. What does that mean? If you tell me, I'm going to give you some good reasons for missing quizzes, and I'll listen. I'm very specific about everything because I don't like dealing with those questions in my office hours. If you tell me you have a good reason for missing a quiz, I'll assume you have a good reason. I don't need a doctor's note. I don't need a note from your mother, your father, your grandmother, your grandfather. Okay, so I'm going to cut you that slack, but in return, I'd like you to deal with this class on the same terms, which is, I'm going to tell you this class is the most important class that you will take at Stern, and that is absolutely true. In fact, none of the other classes even matter, and I'm going to be open about that. But I'm also going to tell you that this is not the most important thing in your life. Okay, so what I'd like you to do is step back and have some perspective. So don't freak out on that half a point on quiz one. So I'm going to try to save myself some heat because you're going to say half a point. I should have got the half a point. Let it go. Have a karmic view of these things. It happened. It's done. Move on. Okay? So relax. Step back. Enjoy yourself. It's going to be a fun ride. So let me get started with some administrative stuff. I already got my office number wrong on all your lecture notes. Here's one of the advantages of hanging around long enough is they give you a bigger office. So I finally got moved into a bigger office. That office number actually shares exactly the same numbers as my old office number. There's some cosmic message I should be getting from this, but I'm not getting it. It's 969, not 996. So this isn't some dyslexic problem I'm having. It's just a different office. I used to be in 996. I am now in 969. So cross it out. I don't want to freak out the person in 969 with you guys all popping and saying, hey, what's going on? Okay. My phone number is there. Don't call me. I never answer the phone. I checked my voicemail yesterday. It filled up to the brim. I just deleted all the voicemails. It's like 6 months worth of voicemails. So it's just because I'm supposed to put it up there. If you want to find me, you can always find me. My email address is up there. So if you send me an email, you will get an answer sooner rather than later. Okay? Office hours. I have two classes on Monday and Wednesday, the MBA class in the morning and your class in the afternoon. I don't want to ruin the rest of the days of my week. Actually, let me take that back. My office hours are actually going to be on Monday, Wednesday, between my classes. They're going to be before my first class, 9:45 to 10:20. And my guess is you probably want to let the MBAs kind of have that because it's just before their class. If they're frantic or psychotic or whatever, you know, they can deal with that. The 1 to 2:30 is perhaps the best time for you to come and see me, but I'm going to say something very strange. If you really want to spend some time in my office, don't do it during office hours. I have what I call the fair game principle. Here's how it goes. If you catch me, I am fair game. So for the next 15 weeks, the game is going to be for you not to catch me. So I'm going to do things like take the stairs, because I know you guys are too lazy to ever take the stairs. No. So you're going to be taking the elevator. You're never going to find me there. Or maybe you will. But if you do, I'll jump off the elevator and start climbing up the stairs. But really, if you catch me anywhere and you have any question about corporate finance evaluation, if you have questions about life, I'm not a good person to ask. I'm, you know, too flippant. But if you have questions about corporate finance evaluation, if you catch me, I'm fair game. I mean, some people really push this to the limit. I remember about a few years ago, you know, I used to go to Kohl's. I've stopped doing that, you know, since the whole thing is like a construction zone probably soon. But I was on a treadmill, and this person would get on the treadmill every single day, right when I got it. And as I was on the treadmill, he would ask me questions. So I'd institute a new rule. If my pulse rate exceeds 100, I will not be responsible for any of the answers I give you. So don't catch me in the middle of, you know, working out or something, which I'm probably not going to do. No. But other than that, fair game. The reason I say that is office hours, I think, create their own psychological problems, because people say, I have to find them in office hours. You'll find me outside office hours. So if you don't have a question to ask, don't slot in just-in-case time in office hours. We have better things. You and I both have better things to do. There are three teaching assistants for the class. They've all taken this class. Now, Umbretta is here. You know, she's an incredibly good TA. They will be running weekly sessions once a week to kind of cover the material, the practical working through numbers part of the class. For those of you who get really worried about, can I get that stuff done, I would strongly encourage you go to those sessions sometime this week or next. I will list out the times for those sessions. I'll have to get a room, but basically there'll be a Google shared spreadsheet. You go in and sign up, because those rooms fit only 50. Usually there'll be about 20, 25 people, except in the quiz week. So, you know, the weeks before the quizzes. So if you want to sign up, you know, take advantage of them. Okay. I'm going to, in a sense, dominate your lives for the next 15 weeks. So I'm going to tell you what's going to happen by day of the week. Okay? Each day will bring its own torture. Yeah? First, why did that happen? Monday there will be a class, like right now. Sometime later today you will get an email from me. You will get in some total about an email a day for the rest of this semester. Create my own mailbox if you need to, because you will get about 125 emails over the next 15 weeks. About what? I'll nag you. I'll harass you. I'll prod you. I won't let you go. Basically, I'm not going to let you say in the third week, I give up on this class. I'm going to drag you across the finish line if it's the last thing you do. It won't be the last thing I do, but it's the last thing you do. Okay? So Monday there'll be a class, there'll be a follow-up. Follow-up, don't get too obsessed. I'm going to say, this is what we did in class. I said, but we were just in class. Let's face it, you might be physically in class, but like the Watergate tapes, you have those mental breakdowns in the middle of class. You know what I'm talking about? Where your mind leaves for about 10 minutes and comes back and says, oh my God, what happened? Don't freak out. You get an email saying, this is what happened in those missing 10 minutes. So it'll be a short summary of what happened in the class. And if there's something in the news that day that is relevant to the topic of the class, I'll say, hey, did you get a chance to read this? Do I expect you to read it? I don't expect you to do most of the things I'm going to ask you to do. Okay? You have other things in your life. I'm going to, as I said, you know, people have described this class as trying to drink out of a hose. Things are going to spray. Take what you can, do what you can, let the rest go. Okay? But I'm going to say, if you want this, if you're really fascinated, if you're as fascinated as I am, hey, try this out. So you will get an email right after the class. On Tuesday, there's going to be a corporate finance puzzle of the week, starting probably next week. I'm going to give you a week's break. What is this? I'm going to pick something in the news that week that's big. Like this week, the Apple earnings announcement this evening is going to be a huge story. And if it ties into what we're doing in the class, I'm going to do a little puzzle around it. And I'm going to, you know, so it's going to be a news story with a structure and some questions. And I'm going to send it out to all of you. What do I expect you to do? If you get a chance, I want you to try the puzzle out and try to answer the questions. If you don't, I don't care. But each week I will send you the puzzle, and maybe some of you will try the puzzle out. Because as I said, this is a class we learn by doing. And the more you can get your hands dirty. So the corporate finance puzzles, again, it's not going to be a big deal. It's going to be something related to that week. On Wednesday, there'll be another class, and there'll be another follow-up email. On Thursday, I will email you about the project. You're saying, what project? Don't worry. You're going to find out in a few minutes. It's going to be a semester. It just started, actually, already. You don't even know it started. It's going. So starting each week, I'll say, and this is really my way of guilting you. Because it'll come with a little calendar saying, this is where you're supposed to be on the project, with a little arrow. And in your head, there'll be another arrow that says, I haven't even started. And the gap between the two arrows will get wider and wider each week until somebody freaks out and has a breakdown. Hopefully that won't happen. You'll start working the arrows together. So this is my nagging email saying, hey, this is where you're supposed to be on the project. Have you got started? Every Friday, I'm going to send you, I love doing YouTube videos. I'm like the Kim Kardashian of YouTube. Man. So I do these 10, 12-minute videos every week. Things like how to read a 10K, how to convert operating. So something we did in class, I'm going to take a real compass and say, hey, you want to do this? This is how you get the numbers from a 10K. This is how you convert it. This is why we do it. It's kind of a little practical, you know, embed yourself in the numbers. And doing it as a webcast actually works great because I can sit in front of my computer, pull up the stuff online, say, this is where I went, this is what I used. So every Friday for the next 15 weeks, you'll get a little in-practice webcast. Saturday, you get a newsletter. Don't expect a lot of news in it. It's a 2-page newsletter. And here's what it'll say. This is what we did this week. This is where we're going next week. Think of it as your GPS for this class. Okay? Essentially saying, this is where and it'll list out, you know, this is what we did, you know, these are the things that are coming up. So it's just a little reminder on what's coming. On Sunday, you'll get another email saying what's coming the week ahead. So each day of the week, you're going to get something. Will I give you a break? Maybe for 5 days during spring break, I won't email you. Okay. 5 days, that's about the limit. And if you go a day without an email, you should check the obituaries to see if I passed away. Because it's not normal. I mean, it's usually there is an email pretty much every day of the week. So some very simple rules. I have very few rules. As I said, I treat you like grown-ups as long as you behave like grown-ups. Try to be here and try to be on time. Try. I will start at 3:30 and end at 4:45 every class. Because what happens if I keep moving till you guys get here is 3:30 will become 3:32, 3:34, 3:36. So I'll start at 3:30 whether you're here. The only person who actually has to be here for this class to go on is me. So I'm going to be here at 3:28. Even if there's nobody in the class, I'm going to start at 3:30. And I might run over a little on 3:45. So I break my own rules when it comes to being on time. So I might go to 3:46 or 3:47. So don't make any urgent appointments at 3:46. You won't make them. Okay? So be here and on time. If you cannot make it, I'll give you some backup. Because again, as grown-ups, you have other stuff in your lives. You'll have interviews. You have, you know, family commitments. You have just feeling sick. So I'll tell you what to do if you miss a class. It's not the end of the world. This is a big class. Why am I saying that? Because every year when they do the CFEs, this will be one of the reviews that comes in. This was a big class. When did that hit you? So look around. It's a big class. That's a big plus, actually. If you ever have to make an announcement, they're all here. In fact, the MBAs, it's even better. My MBA class is 365 and counting right now. It is every person in the first year of the MBA program, which is an incredible opportunity if you have to make announcements. Right? So I'm going to actually create a Google Shared spreadsheet because one of the things is, you know, I can't be dealing with announcements just before the class. Can I make an announcement? So I'll create a Google Shared spreadsheet. I'm going to use Google Shared spreadsheets a lot because partly because the logistics are otherwise difficult. And I'm going to let people sign up for each day if you have an announcement. So if you don't, that's fine. I'll just get started. But there's one announcement per day, so you can go and fill in that slot if need be. There's a lecture note packet. How many of you have not been getting my emails? Okay, everybody has been getting. So all three? Okay. There was, if you're not a, I think if you're not a Stern student and you're in this class, then somehow you're getting lost in the email list because a few people who are especially were not here today, you know, emailing me over the weekend. Now, so I'm glad everybody's here because I've also sent the link to your lecture note packet. I know you haven't even seen it, but go back and look. There's a link to the lecture note packet. Just print off the first packet. The second packet is in process. Why? Because there are a few things that I want to update to 2016 numbers. It'll be ready in a couple of weeks. So download and print off the packet. The only plea I will make is, please don't use the printers in school. I will hear about it. I mean, can you imagine 250 people printing 330 pages apiece? I've broken more printers in the school than any other professor, and they call me and say, what the hell is going on? My first response is, how much do you collect in tuition from these guys? No, that's not my first response. So that should be my first response. That might be so if you're going to print it, if a part-time job, do it at work. They don't even know what you're printing off. Right? Whatever you need to do is slide it in somewhere. Now, but if you really, really have money to throw away, which some of you might, then go to the bookstore. And they will have it. Unfortunately, the bookstore being the bookstore managed to lose the entire lecture note packet that I sent 3 weeks ago. I don't know how that happened. So yesterday I had to send a new packet down. So if it's at the bookstore, it probably will not be ready till Friday or Saturday. But you're okay. You will survive the first week without lecture notes. So don't worry about it. If you want, you can print off. Just I'll tell you which pages we might cover on Wednesday. But if you want to buy it, it'll probably be priced exorbitantly. Bookstore being the bookstore. Okay. If you do miss a class, you can catch up because this class is going to be available. If you go to the link for this class, and I'll show you the link, the webcast page at the end of every class, what will happen is there'll be four links that you can click on for this class. The first is a stream. Basically, you got to be connected. You stream it, so you see the lecture. You see it. So this is, but that requires broadband, it requires you to be connected, but no, so that's the first choice. The second is, I will put it on YouTube. The advantage of YouTube is you can watch it on smaller devices, adjust to whatever your broadband speed is, so the lectures will go on YouTube. There'll be a downloadable video file for those of you who are going on long flights, and this is not what you're going to watch, why you do this, I don't know. Maybe to torture the person next to you in the plane, hey? It'll be available as a downloadable video. It's going to be a huge file. So I'm going to warn you ahead of time that if you want to do this, remember it'll probably be a gigabyte. No. I'm also going to create a downloadable audio file. Why? Who knows? You might be driving, you want to listen on the radio, you're working out on a treadmill, you say, I want to listen to a lecture. You know, stranger things have happened. I've actually walked behind a person in New York City a couple of years ago. And I hear this voice, and it's like my voice. I peek over this guy's shoulder, and he's watching my video on his YouTube. No, I didn't want to ask him what he thought about the video. It might not have been a good moment. But basically, that's why if you miss a class, it's not going to be the end of the world. A couple of hubs I'm going to create. The hub for this class has got to be fixed. So type add a UG to it at the end. It says CorpFin. In cap letters, add UG at the end because I'm going to create two separate pages. Initially, I was going to do one for both classes, but I think it might make sense to create two. That's going to be the web page for this class. Okay? So I'll send the link out as well, but that's the page where everything's going to be contained. I don't like NYU classes. I don't like closed systems. I never like Blackboard. I'll try to put things on, but I'll tell you up front that somewhere in the fourth week, I'm going to lose interest. So NYU classes, I'm going to use only for the stuff that I absolutely need to use it for. Everything you need will be at that webpage. How many of you have Apple devices? iPhones, iPads. Okay? If you go to the Apple iTunes store, you can download an app called iTunes U. I don't know whether you already have it, but this class is going to be carried on iTunes U, which means every lecture is going to be on there. I'll put the slides, the link to it. So it's actually a great platform for the whole class. There'll probably be about 10,000 people taking this class with you, not officially. Okay? So don't worry about them. You are my only, I'm going to pay attention only to you. Okay? But that's at iTunes U. You can download the class and watch the class. So basically, if you prefer a more polished platform, iTunes U will probably work best. And I told you about the YouTube channel. All the classes will start to show up on the YouTube channel when you're done. A couple more organizing details. I sent you the link to my Google Calendar. Why did I send it to you? So that you know exactly when the quizzes are coming and when the final exam date is still up in the air, so I'll put it up as soon as it's ready. But the Google Calendar is essentially going to list out every big item related to the class, including the project and the classes themselves. In case you run out of things to do this semester, which is very unlikely, I post on my blog probably 4 or 5 times a month. Nothing personal, it's all corporate finance and valuation related. So if there's something there that might be interesting for this class, I'll draw your attention to it. But I go all over the place. And a few weeks ago, right after Christmas, I valued the Star Wars franchise. Guess how much it's worth? My estimate, $10 billion. Why? Because for every dollar that Disney makes at the box office on Star Wars, it makes $4 out of the box office. From merchandising, streaming, it's a $10 billion. How much did Disney pay for Star Wars? Do you remember?
$4 billion.
Now you know why George Lucas is pissed off. With his white slaver comments. You got $4 billion, buddy. You sold too low. That's your problem. Now don't take it out on Disney. It's $10 billion. Or a couple of years ago when Steve Ballmer bought the Clippers, I valued the Clippers. Oh, one of my favorites. Remember you know who Arian Foster is? Okay. He's running back for the Houston whatever. Okay. And about 2 years ago, there's this company which issued tracking stock on Arian Foster. I'm not kidding. You could buy a share of Arian Foster's earnings in perpetuity. You wish you'd bought a share of Cam Newton's earnings in perpetuity today, don't you? But it was a fun valuation because he was, a 30-year-old running back. A 30-year-old running back in the NFL is ancient. Your knees are pretty much beaten up. So you've taken expected life, expected payoff, expected endorsements. It was the most fun I had. It should be illegal to have this much fun. Right? But so my blog is not serious academic stuff that I left behind about 15 years ago. Right? It's whatever interests me. So maybe I can drag you into some of my obsessions, and if you're interested, you can read about it. I have a Twitter feed. I'm very new age. Okay? I don't have any Tinder connections and stuff, so don't worry. I will not be reaching in inappropriate ways. I'm appropriately new age. I have a Twitter feed, and I have a price I can offer you. I'm at 49,400 followers. I'm thinking of having this big contest for about 50,000 followers. So if you can push me to 50,000, if any of you have 6,000 email addresses, you could probably do it on your own. But if you don't, keep adding to the number, come back to it. The 50,000th follower will get a mega prize. I don't know what it is, but it'll be a mega prize. Okay. So now we're into the meat and potatoes. Right? So let's talk about what this class will be about. It's corporate finance, right? You've already come in with preconceptions about what you think this class is about. All those preconceptions are wrong. I'll give you my definition of corporate finance, and it's incredibly self-serving. Corporate finance covers any decision that involves the use of money. You see why it's self-serving? What have I just said? Everything is corporate finance. You thought you were doing marketing? Corporate finance. Strategy? Corporate finance. Accounting? Corporate finance. In fact, start of MBA programs, they have this 1 week in this, where they bring in MBAs before and those of you going for MBAs will probably go through this. They call it a week where they introduce you to the program. It's really a brainwashing week, where they bring you in and tell you everything you've learned in your life up till that point is useless, and what you will learn in the next 2 years is the only thing that matters. A complete lie. But if they're going to charge you $200,000, they've got to set the platform. That's when they set the platform. So about 8 years ago, they asked me to come in during this week and talk to the incoming MBA class. They haven't invited me back since, so I must have done something wrong. So they said, can you come in and talk to these MBAs? Because they'll all be taking your corporate finance class in the first year. Can you talk about your class? I said, sure, that'll be easy to do. So I came in with a flow chart. I said, there's my class, and I've already told you this. Everything else you're doing in this program is in service of my class. That accounting guy, jumping through hoops, debit, credit, acts like he's a big shot. He's just supplying raw data to me. That's his job. The marketing guy with the 4 P's or the 6 P's or the 16 P's or whatever P's there are in marketing. You know why it matters? Because it affects my margins, my returns on capital, my cash flows, my value. The production guy on the shop floor with all his little ratios affects me through the cost of goods sold. Strategy guys with all his big stories affects me only to the extent that those big stories affect my numbers. This is a class that's going to anchor everything you do in the program. So you're going to be drawing on things you heard a year ago, 6 months ago, 3 months ago, and perhaps things you will be hearing during the course of the semester. It's going to be somewhere in this class. Everything is corporate finance. So I have 3 objectives for the class. I'm going to lay them out right now. And I'm going to come back in the 28th session, which is what, May 12th or whenever it is? I'm going to come back in the 28th session. I'm going to ask you, did I do my job? So here's the first one. This is a class that's going to teach you how to apply tools to real companies. I have a very simple rule in my class. If it cannot be applied, I'm not going to talk about it. I have no interest in theory for the sake of theory. So everything we do in this class will be applied, and I'll make it concrete in about 15 minutes. Everything will be applied. Second, this is a big picture class. What does that mean? When I talk to the MBAs a week from now, I ask them a question, and perhaps I could ask some of you the same question because during the summers you might have worked in a corporate finance-related job. For the MBAs, though, they've come in with 4 or 5 years of experience. Some of them have come through the banking programs, Goldman Sachs, the Morgan Stanleys, so they've come back to the MBA program. So I ask them, how many of you worked in corporate finance? And about a third of the class will put up their hands and say, I was in corporate finance. But here's the reality. If you go to work in corporate finance, often you end up doing a small piece of a small piece of a really small piece of a really small piece. You're a specialist. That's the nature of the process. You've done the same thing over and over again for 5 years. You're really good at it, but you have no idea why you do what you do. You do it because you're really good at it and you're supposed to do it. This class is about elevating you, pulling you up, saying this is where things fit together. When you graduate, odds are you're not going to be in the big picture person, but you need to know where you fit in the big picture to do whatever you do much better. So this is a big picture class, and again, I'm going to make that concrete as well. So that's my second objective. I have a third objective, and this is going to sound a little sick. I think corporate finance is fun. Fun in the same way doing a crossword is fun. It's like a puzzle. Pieces fit together. And what I hope you will get is that sense when pieces fit together, and it'll happen on its own pace for each of you. When the pieces start to come together, you, in a sense, will unlock the code. Basically, once you get past that threshold, you've got it. There's no additional class you need to take. You either have it or you don't. It's a lot of fun, but here's the way I see it. I'm going to have a lot of fun in this class. Why? They're going to pay me. Might as well have fun while they pay me. You have 2 choices. You can watch me have fun. That's a lot of work. It'll make you feel resentful. This guy's having all the fun. I'm just sitting here. Or you can join in. So hopefully you're going to say, hey, this guy is having all the fun. Why should he have all the fun? Let me jump in. So I'm going to try to make this fun for all of us. It will not feel like fun on May 10th when your project is due and your exam's right around the corner. So I'm not going to ask you, are you having fun now? Because that will create all kinds of potential problems. But hopefully after the exam is over and I give you a couple of weeks to cool off, I say, was that a little fun? Maybe a little bit. No. I'm also going to say something that I say at the start of my evaluation classes. How many of you are natural storytellers? And how many of you are natural number crunchers? I want you to think about you as a person and ask yourself, am I more naturally a storyteller or a number cruncher? Ready? Each of you is thinking? Oh, come on. There's no right answer. So what does he want me to say? Hey, think for yourself. I'll tell you when you start to come to this realization. For me, it happened when I was about 13, right after my first English literature class. They made us read Moby Dick. For you, it might have been Life of Pi. And I read Moby Dick, and I thought it was about a whale and Captain Ahab. I come in, and they start talking about all these hidden meanings. I said, really? Really? And I came out of that class, and never again will I subject myself to that bullshit. And you know, the rest of my life was laid out for me. Never again did I walk into a social science class unless I was dragged in. No, that's like the plague. I'd rather have the ebonic plague than go into that class. So it was after that, it was algebra 1, algebra 2, algebra 3, algebra 4, algebra to the nth power. And you're off to the races. Right? In fact, you read The Life of Pi. I thought it was about this idiot who gets on a raft with a tiger. Nothing good can come out of this, right? Then I find out that there was no raft. I said, I read about the raft. There was no tiger. I said, what do you mean there was no tiger? The whole thing was made up. Was something. This is the kind of stuff you want. So I got out of that class. I was on the number crunching route. And once you get to college, you're off to the races. So you're in business school. You've nurtured your number crunching side. If there's a left brain and a right brain, your left brain is just inflated to the point of exploding at this point. You've crunched with numbers. You know what you've done to your poor right brain? You've beaten it. You bludgeoned it. Every time your imagination, get down there. You're not supposed to show up. I'm a business person. I'm a numbers person. Now, there are also some of you who might be storytellers trapped in business school. You know the ones. I'll tell you when this happened. It was probably around the same age as me. The same class you went in, he said, and as those hidden meanings came out, he said, that is amazing. That's such insight. And then you went home and wrote some poetry about it. And then you were off to the races with your own set of classes, right? And my MBA class, about a third of the class, are history majors and literature majors. Number crunchers and storytellers. So I'm going to tell you what my objective is in this class and my evaluation class. If you're a number cruncher, I'd like you to develop an imagination during this class. This class is not just about crunching numbers. It's about taking those numbers and really telling a good story with those numbers. And if you're a storyteller, I hope you use this class to develop some discipline. Because you know what the problem with storytelling is? There's this line that you often cross between reality and fantasy. The next thing you know, you're telling me a fairy tale. So each of you can get something out of this class. So basically what I want you to do is work on your weak side. So if you're really great at Excel spreadsheets, that's wonderful. But start to build up that imagination that goes into numbers. So let's lay the foundation for this class. So when did you guys take accounting? How many, what year was that? 2 years ago, a year ago? You continue? When was the last accounting class you took?
I took one last semester and one before that.
I hope you stop at two. Because beyond that, the brainwashing gets overwhelming. So accounting basically prepares. People think they have to take an accounting class. In fact, quite a few email me saying, I'm really not that comfortable with accounting. Am I going to have trouble with the class? And I have mixed feelings. You do need to get comfortable enough with accounting to be able to read financial statements. But the first thing I want to do in this class is get you out of the accounting mindset. Okay, let's see if the mindset is set already and I have a lot more work to do. You've all seen accounting balance sheets, right? This is an accounting balance sheet. And accountants have their own weird logic of how they see a company. So as I go through each item, I'm going to ask you to call back that accounting memory and tell me how accountants would show this number on a balance sheet. So if you invest in land, building, equipment, long-lived real assets, how do accountants record it on a balance sheet? What are the accounting rules that drive it? Yep. It's the, that's what the item is called, but how do they come up with that number? What goes into PP&E? I'll try to repeat almost every question. One of the problems with this room is it was designed and built by an architect who never thought about the fact that classes go two ways. So the acoustics might be great for me talking to you, but you talk to me, nobody else can hear. So I'll repeat everything. So the answer was PP&E, property, plant, and equipment. Let's stop, try to stay away from acronyms as much as we can. It's because after a while it'll get us into trouble. But property, plant, and equipment might be what accountants call these assets, but how do they come up with a number? So you open a Coca-Cola's balance sheet. It says property, plant, and equipment. How do accountants come up with that number? Your accounting must be pretty fresh. Give it a guess. I'll make you look really smart. I'll fill in the details, you know.
They value all of the assets they currently possess?
Oh, let's not use the word value at all. Accountants, if you have property, plant, and equipment, record it at what you originally paid. Continue the story. Then what do they do in the years after? They depreciate it, say, and you got to take them at their word when they say this is how much I depreciate. So basically, fixed assets get recorded at original cost, net of depreciation as accountants see it, supposedly because the asset is losing value. So that's the rule with fixed assets. What about current assets, accounts receivable, inventory? How did those get recorded? Want to give it a shot? You want to try? Okay, so they're recorded at cost, but there the difference between cost and current value is smaller. Why? Because hopefully the inventory is not 16 years old, right? So current assets are also recorded at cost. There's no depreciation because they're usually more updated, but it's closer to current value. But fixed assets, if I bought land 55 years ago, can you imagine how different the number you're going to see on the balance sheet is from the real value? Then you got financial investments, investments in other companies. Like what? Let me take an example. You're all familiar with Yahoo? What's Yahoo's business, if it has one still? It has a search engine that nobody uses, and Yahoo Mail that's used by 75-year-olds in Asia. That seems to be the big market. So basically, it's a business that's shrinking. I mean, last year I valued Yahoo's business, its operating business, at $5 billion. It's a big deal. Its market cap was $40 billion. You see, this is absurd. But Yahoo has two big investments that I did not count in the $5 billion. You know what those two investments are? What makes Yahoo such a valuable company? One is it owns 14% of Alibaba. Even on a bad day, 14% of Alibaba is worth about $21 billion. You know what it's recorded in Yahoo's balance sheet at? $1.5 billion. Why $1.5 billion? Because that's what Jerry Yang paid for Alibaba in 2005 when he bought that stake in Alibaba. It's recorded at original cost. You think this makes no sense? It makes complete accounting sense, and that's the first thing to remember. Accounting sense and common sense are two different. Right? So from an accounting perspective, it makes complete sense. It was what you originally paid. But there's another investment they've made. So Alibaba is worth about $21 billion. So we've gone from 5. 5 plus 21. We're up at 26. You know what the other one is? They own 35% of Yahoo Japan. And for some reason, the Japanese still seem to like the Yahoo search engine. Don't ask me why. And that 35%, because it's a publicly traded company, is worth another $15 billion. So you got $5 billion from the operating assets, $20 billion plus from Alibaba, $15 billion from Yahoo Japan. The Yahoo Japan investment is recorded at $1 billion. So with financial investments, accountants will often show what you originally paid to get that investment. And then you get to intangible assets. Let's step back. Let's not think like accountants. Let's think like normal human beings. I come to you with a company, Coca-Cola. What's the biggest intangible asset you see in Coca-Cola? Trade secret. Oh, my God. Next thing you'll be saying, syrup. Syrup doesn't matter. The trade secrets don't matter. What's Coca-Cola's biggest brand name? I gave away the answer. Its biggest asset, its logo, or its brand name. What's the power of a brand name? You get to charge a higher price for exactly the same product. You want to see brand name at play? Walk into a CVS. Walk down the aspirin aisle and check out the bare aspirin and the generic aspirin. In fact, if you're suspicious, turn both bottles around to see what the ingredients are. They're exactly the same. But bare aspirin trades at, or is priced at, three times the generic aspirin. Oh, come on, you bought the Sudafed over the Sudafed, generic Sudafed 100 times because he said, if I take the real Sudafed, my allergies seem to go away faster. That's the power of a brand name, is they've taken over your brain. So with Coca-Cola, the biggest asset is brand name. With Apple, what's the biggest asset? You're taking out your iPhone saying, oh, I'm not paying for this. It's coolness factor, it's styling, it's the Apple operating. I'm an Apple user for 35 years. You'd have to drag me to hell to use a Windows operating system. So all those things come into play, intangible asset. What I'm trying to say is when we think of intangible assets, we can think of all these different things that are intangible assets. But if you look at an accounting balance sheet, what's the most common intangible asset you see on an accounting balance sheet? Come on, you've seen it. If you've seen enough balance sheets, you've seen this item. 85% of all accounting intangible assets is one item. Goodwill. The most useless and misnamed accounting item in history. And here's why. For goodwill to manifest itself on a balance sheet, what does a company have to do? It has to acquire another company. And herein lies the problem. So if I'm the greatest company on the face of the earth and I've grown entirely with internal investments, there will be no goodwill on my balance sheet. The minute I do an acquisition, goodwill shows up. Okay, so you can help me out on the rest. When I acquire another company, how does the accountant compute goodwill? What is it, the difference between? What it's paid for, you're right. And I'd love to tell you it's what it's valued at, but it's really assets of the company as measured by whom? By the accountant. It's the difference between what you paid for an asset and its book value. You can dance around that book value, you can dress it up a little. But dressing up book value is like dressing up a turkey. They've got that straggly little neck, you know, even if you put really good looking clothes on them, turkeys never look good. So here's what happens. You have a company, a target company, the book value of $4 billion. I pay $10 billion. The accountant has a $6 billion problem to explain away, right? Do you see why? Because until yesterday, what was the accountant saying? It's worth $4 billion. It's worth $4 billion. Oops, it's worth $10 billion. He takes that $6 billion, he puts it on the balance sheet, and he calls it goodwill. You know why he has to do it? The balance sheet has this very unpleasant requirement, which is it has to balance. There's one reason and one reason alone why goodwill exists on a balance sheet. It is to make the balance sheet balance. And the little problem with goodwill is it sounds good. And when something sounds good, what do people feel the urge to do? They want to pay for it. Every week I get emails from people valuing companies. I've just valued the company. But there's $3 billion in goodwill. How much should I pay for it? You feel like slapping the person around the face, saying, wake up. It's a plug variable. What the heck are you doing paying for it? So I have a very simple proposal for accountants. Accountants don't seem to listen to my proposals, but if they did, they will take this. That goodwill be renamed X. So you know how in algebra you put an X? That way you take all the mystery out of it. People will never call you and say, how much should I pay for X? And if they do call you on this, take them for all they're worth. On the other side of the balance sheet, let's see how accountants record the word. current liabilities, accounts payable, supplier credit, deferred this, deferred that, deferred everything under the sun, are recorded usually pretty close to current costs because it just happened recently. It's almost accidental. Long-term liabilities, bank loans, corporate bonds. So when you look at a company, you see debt. You know what the accountant is recording? What you originally borrowed 3 years ago. You're saying, it's still that same borrowing. If you're Glencore, you familiar with Glencore? Huge commodity company. You know what commodity companies are going through right now. Look at oil companies. 3 years ago, you borrowed money at 3%. Today, that same debt, the interest rate is up to 10%. The accountant says, don't worry about it. It's still the same amount. So it's recorded original cost. Again, to be consistent with the way the assets are recorded. And then you have other liabilities. What are these? These are made up accounting things as they go along. You know, so basically, every time accountants sneeze, a new item pops up on the balance sheet. And finally, you have what's called shareholders' equity. So you look at any balance sheet, this is like the big number that accountants need. Look, there's shareholders' equity. So when I open up Coca-Cola's balance sheet and look at shareholders' equity, what do you think goes into it? How do accountants come up with that number? It's everything that has happened to Coca-Cola over their entire lifetime is in that number. That IPO that Coca-Cola did, when is it, 100 years ago, is in there. Plus every retained earnings since. If you're doing a math problem, this will be the accumulation of all your retained earnings over history. And that brings me to the first aspect of the accounting mindset. Accountants are historians. That's their job. They record what happened. It's not a bad job. It's a boring job. But it's a, you know, somebody's got to do it. They record what's happened. So an accounting balance sheet is a history of everything that has happened to you as a company. You think, so what? Let's say I called you into Snapchat. You heard of Snapchat? Come on, you have Snapchat on your phones. You just want to admit to it. And you looked at their balance sheet. What are you going to see? Or Square, or Twitter. What common characteristic do these companies all share? They're all young companies. See what I'm saying? If accounting is a recording of history with young companies, what are you going to see on the balance sheet? Not much. It's like writing the history of Slovenia. My wife's Slovenian. So it's no insult to Slovenia, but Slovenia is, what, 12 years old as a country. The history of Slovenia is probably a brochure, 5 pages long. This is not the history of the Roman Empire. So if you look at a young company, an accounting balance sheet is going to have nothing in it, not because the accountants haven't done their job, it's that they don't have much to record. So get ready. When you look at a young company, look at the balance sheet, there'll be nothing there. That's an accounting balance sheet. So accountants are historians. Accountants are rule-driven. You know what I mean by rule-driven? I still remember when the accounting panel was writing fair value accounting rules. This is an oxymoron to begin with. Fair value accounting, yeah, I can either do accounting or value, you can't do both. But they thought they could pull it off. So they asked me to come in and talk to them as a panel. And they haven't again invited. This seems to be a pattern for me as I go talk to people, they don't invite me back. So they asked me to come in and talk to them about their fair value accounting rules. And I said, can you send me what you're planning to do? So they send me this rule that they're planning to write. It's called FAS 157. I didn't even read the rule. I looked at it and I freaked out. You know why, right? It's FAS 157. What does it tell you? There are 156 other rules you haven't even heard of yet. That's the way accounting thinks. When they're in trouble, they will write more rules. They're rule-driven. It's historical and rule-driven. So the first thing I want you to do in this class is get out of the accounting mindset if you're trapped in there. For those of you who want to go back into accounting, this class will actually damage you beyond repair. Right? You will never be a happy accountant again, if there is such a thing. Right? So let's do the financial mindset. This is the way I see companies. This is a financial balance sheet, and a financial balance sheet at one level is far simpler than an accounting balance sheet. At another level, it's far more complex. Notice there are only two items on each side. on one side, I have the assets. And my assets, the way I see companies, is I divide the value up into value coming from investments you've already made as a company. I call that assets in place. I don't care whether they're fixed or intangible. I don't care. If you've already made them, that goes into assets in place. And the second is what I call growth assets. What is that? This is the value that I give you as a company on the expectation of investments you will make next year, 2 years out, 5 years out, 10 years out, 50 years out, 500 years out. An accountant couldn't do that, but I can. So assets in place and growth assets. On the other side of the balance sheet, there are only two ways you can fund a business. You can borrow the money or use your own money. You can dance around this as much as you want. You can call them bonds and stocks, but basically it's debt and equity. It's a much simpler and a more powerful way to think about the world. Let me illustrate. Let's take two companies that you might be familiar with. The first company is going to be Microsoft. You guys are going to be looking at Microsoft. And the second is going to be Snapchat. So you guys are going to have a fun job of looking at Snapchat. Let's take Microsoft. What's the value of assets in place for Microsoft? What are the investments they've already made that give value to them? There are only two things Microsoft has ever done in its life that make it money. Come on.
Windows
and Office. Oh, Xbox is teetering on the edge. I wish it made money for them. But it's like teetering between it. But there's only Windows and Office. It's like a two-hit wonder. One of those persons who comes and does one song. Microsoft did two hit songs, big hits. So those are cash cows. Cash cows are getting a little thinner. Why? Because Windows and Office are both desktop driven as we move increasingly to devices. Yeah. But still very, very, very rich cash cows. Collectively, those two investments alone are probably worth about $250 billion. It's a great business to be in. You run out of cash, you do an upgrade. Windows 2016, there's $2 billion. You're still out of cash. Do Windows 2017. You freak people out as you go along. But you'll be collecting cash along the way. So assets in place, Windows and Office. Everything else that Microsoft has done is more liability than asset. This is the Microsoft pattern. It comes up with a new product. And you can name them over the last 20 years. The Zoom, the this, the that. And basically, they invest about $4 billion with lots of fanfare. This is going to change the world. And 3 years later, they say, sorry, write it off. So this is the pattern. This is what the cash allows them to do. So that's Microsoft. Let's take Snapchat. You're familiar with Snapchat and how it works, right? My daughter alone has probably, last year, I think she sent 3,850 Snapchats. She's not a little kid. She's 20. But she Snapchats everything. During dinner, 15 Snapchats of her eating chicken. Why you would care, I don't know. But Snapchat's big allure is that you take pictures, and what's supposed to happen to them? People check them, and it disappears. And this is a great plus if you're up that age. And I will leave that age kind of unspecified. But the age where you send pictures, where you regret them about 15 minutes, 5 hours, oh, my God, what was I even thinking? Okay. Snapchat has a lot of users, about 35 million users, who are very dedicated to it. But it has one small problem. It hasn't figured out how to make money off them. Why? Because when you put an ad on Snapchat, 15 seconds later, what happens to the ad? It also goes away. This is not good for an advertiser, right? They want you to remember. So they're still trying to wrestle with how to make money off these users. So right now, the value of assets in place at Snapchat is close to zero. But could those 30 million users potentially be worth a lot of money? Yeah. In fact, last year people assessed the value of Snapchat at $15 billion. Now we can debate whether it's 15 or 12 or 8 or 9, but you can see with Snapchat, all of the value is coming from growth assets. File that away, because in a few minutes I'm going to argue that Corporate Finance 101 can be made really simple if you think just in terms of a financial balance sheet. Two very different companies. One gets all of its value from assets in place. The growth assets are adding nothing. In fact, they might be reducing Microsoft's value. The second gets all of its value from growth assets. But with the financial balance sheet, I'm not trapped by her history. I'm looking forward rather than backward. That's the first difference. In this class, I wanted to constantly look forward. Doesn't mean you can't look backwards to see what happened. But you're always using the history of the company to make forecasts for the future. Second, finance is principle-driven. At the end of this class, you're going to notice I keep saying the same four things over and over and over again. I mean, I'm clever enough to make it look like I'm saying something different, but by the 15 sessions, this guy's been saying the same thing for the last 15 sessions. But that's because in corporate finance, you constantly come back to those first principles. It's a principle-driven class rather than a rule-driven class. Don't look for rules. You have to devise your own solutions to problems based on the principles. It's a different mindset. It takes a while to get there. It takes a little getting used to because you have to be okay with this flexibility that you have, the freedom that you get in finance, but that's the difference. So let me go back to something I promised you as one of my objectives. I said this is a big picture class, and you're skeptical because you hear that in every one of the classes. This is a big picture class, this too. This is a big picture class, and here's the big picture. This is all of corporate finance on one page. I'm going to use this as my anchor for the class. So let me lay out the first principles of corporate finance, and there are only three. The first is called the investment principle. And I'm going to specify it right now. And for the moment, there'll be a lot of missing pieces. I'm not going to give you the details. But think of this as a first principle page. The investment principle says when you as a business go out and make investments, make sure you invest in assets that earn a rate of return or a hurdle or a return that is greater than your minimum acceptable hurdle rate. Already I've thrown a buzzword in there, right? Hurdle rate. I'm not quite ready to give you the specifics, but I'll give you the sub-principle that's going to govern how we think about hurdle rates. The hurdle rate you use for an investment should be higher for riskier investments and lower for safer investments. Stop and think about that for a moment. Does that surprise you? Not really, right? Higher, riskier investments require a higher hurdle rate to be good, safer. We haven't said how much higher. We'll come back and fill in the details. So the hurdle rate should reflect the riskiness of the investment and should reflect where you raise the money. There are only two ways you can raise money, debt or equity, and that mix might affect the hurdle rate. So that's going to be one half of the equation. The return on assets should be based on cash flows, as opposed to what? What do you spend two semesters doing in accounting? What is the proverbial bottom? You're caught now because you're right in the second row and you said you did accounting. What's the bottom line in accounting? Don't worry, it's going to be very simple. Income, earnings, right? And I'm saying, well, those two semesters you spent coming up with accounting earnings, that was such a waste of time. Because in finance, we don't care what you make in earnings. It's all about cash in, cash out, cash flows. Should reflect when those cash flows happen. Hey, don't make this more mysterious than it has to be. You'd rather get the cash flows earlier rather than later, right? This is something we know when we're young. In fact, all my kids, they're all grown up now. My youngest is 17, my oldest is 26. At the age of four, I had to go through a rite of passage where I'd ask them a question which would determine whether we would set aside money for a college fund or not. And here's how the question would go. They all get a weekly allowance. It starts low and builds up. And at the age of four, I'd ask them the question. I'd start early in the week. I'd say, well, you can wait till Saturday to get your allowance or you can get it tomorrow, which is Monday. When would you rather get your allowance? Well, if you said Saturday, I'm saying, you know what? No college fund for you. You might not even be bright enough to make it to a fast food restaurant. Luckily, all four passed the test. Said, rather get, because it's instinctive. My youngest, though, I think I have to set extra money aside for college. He said, Dad, do I get the same allowance? That's a good question, right? Because if you get 20% more, maybe you'll wait till Saturday. Somewhere between the age of 4 and 20, you lose connection with this intuition. And they say, why is that again? Then I have to do a present value tables and discount factors. Let it go. We want cash flows earlier. Discount rates might be the mechanism we have to show that. But we'd rather get cash flows earlier rather than later. So the return should reflect when you get the cash flows. and should have all side effects built into it. What am I talking about? There's a lot of garnishing in investment analysis. What I mean by that is you crunch through the numbers, you come up with a decision. It says, don't do this. And somebody at the table says, but there are strategic considerations. Most dangerous word in business is the word strategic. You know what it means? The numbers don't fly, but I really, really want to do this. That's basically what strategic means. Okay? There are strategic considerations. There's synergy. There's this buzzwords. Such. I call these weapons of mass distraction. Because basically, what are they designed to do? To distract you from the numbers and say, you should really do this. And my job is to be the skunk at the party. So, okay, you want to talk about synergy? Let's talk about synergy. Let's bring it into the numbers. You want to talk about strategic? What's so strategic about this? And I'll try to bring in the numbers. One of the things I'm going to argue for in this class is there's no such thing as a qualitative variable that cannot be converted to numbers. I will take it as a challenge. And through the semester, I will ask you to come up with whatever your favorite qualitative factor is. And my job is to say, this is how I'll bring it in the numbers. Because if I don't, I've given you a free path to essentially override the numbers. So return should reflect the cash flow, should reflect when you get the cash flow, should have all side effects built into it, good or bad. The second big principle in finance is called the financing principle. Remember, there are two ways to raise money, debt and equity. One of the questions that every business has to ask is, what's the right mix of debt and equity for me? Notice how I phrased the question. I didn't say, what's the right mix of debt and equity? Because there can't be one mix that applies across companies. So in corporate finance, the second big question you have to answer is, what's the right mix for a company? Is it 20% debt, no debt, 30% debt, 40% debt, 80% debt? And then if you ask me, what kind of debt is the right debt for my company? I'm going to turn the question back on you. So what do you invest in? Let's say you're an infrastructure company. You invest in assets the last 50 years. What type of debt should I take on? Really long-term debt. Why? Because your assets are really long-term. If your assets all throw off cash flows in euros or rupees or rupiah, your debt should be in the same currency. This isn't rocket science. You match the debt up to the assets you have as a company. So find the right mix of debt and equity. It's the one that minimizes your hurdle rate because you want a lower hurdle rate. And match the debt up to the assets. That's a financing principle. The third and final principle is the dividend principle. And here's what it says. If you cannot find investments that make your hurdle rate, don't push your luck. In other words, if your hurdle rate is 8, and the best you can find out there is 6.5%, don't say, I have to take it. That's the best I can do. There's always a better choice, which is, why do farmers plant crops? This is like, you say, what the heck is he talking about? It's a farming class and agriculture. You plant crops because you want to harvest them. Why do you invest in businesses? There's no glory in the growth for the sake of growth. Sustainability, corporate sustainability, incredibly stupid objective. And we'll talk about why in a couple of sessions. Why make a company last beyond what its useful purpose is? If you cannot find investments that make your hurdle rate, take the cash out of the business. If it's your own business, take the cash out. That's the dividend principle. If it's a public company, it's a little more involved because to take the cash out of the business, there are two ways you can get the cash back to the owners. One is to pay dividends, and the other increasingly in the U.S. is to do what? Buy back stocks. Just a different way. Don't make this, again, any more fancy than it has to be. This is corporate finance as I know it. Everything else in this class is icing on the cake. If you get this page, you've got corporate finance. In fact, I'm going to use this to lay out 5 themes for this class. The first is that nothing I've said so far should have surprised you. Even if you've never taken a corporate finance class, all I've said is if you can raise money at 8% rather than 9%, go raise money at 8%. It's better for you, right? And once you raise money at 8%, please, please, please don't invest that money at 6 or 6.5%. That doesn't make sense. You're saying, I knew this already. You know what? You already know corporate finance. All I'm going to do is give you a structure to take what you already know and dress it up. And here's the implication. If during the course of this class you hear me say something or someone say something that you don't think makes sense, don't let it go. Your job is to make sure that whatever it is, no matter how small it is, you try to bring into, hey, this is why it makes sense. Second, corporate finances focus. I forgot to tell you what the objective. In doing all of the things we do in corporate finance, you have a singular objective. The objective in corporate finance is to maximize the value of your entire business. That's it, singular objective. I don't have five. That's one objective. And the advantage of being so focused is it's going to allow me to come up with pinpoint judgments on this is the best project to take, this is how you should finance, this is how much you should pay in dividends. That's a plus. The minus is, to the degree that you disagree with my objective, nothing is going to make sense to you. So we're actually going to spend 2, maybe 3 sessions on that objective of maximizing value right at the start of the class. Why? Because I think philosophically it lays the foundations for why I think about corporate finance the way I do, but why you might not, because you might disagree with my objectives. So we're going to talk about why maximize the value of the business, why not maximize revenues, why not maximize social impact, why not maximize public welfare, why not there are lots of different objectives. I've chosen one, and it's my job to defend why I chose what I did. And your job to try to pick it apart, because if you don't agree with that objective, you're in a sense going to disagree with everything that follows. Third, I'm going to use a structure that I'm very fond of. This morning, I feel really crappy. You know why I feel really crappy? Because yesterday, all day, I was doing what you do when, I guess, that white stuff arrives. I was shoveling snow like crazy. And today I feel it, every part of me. And I knew I'd feel it yesterday. Why? Because I'm not at an age where I can do that, go to sleep, next morning you wake up and you're all bouncy. I don't jump out of bed anymore. That's a dangerous thing to do. I kind of feel the ground, say, okay, thank God there's a ground. Then I stand up, oh, thank God I stood up. And then the day progresses slowly from there. Why? I have to learn to live, as my daughter tells me, Dad, you're old. Okay, you know, I get it. Companies go through a life cycle as well. So you have a startup, like a baby, right? The future lies ahead of you. Then you have a growth company, like a teenager. Then you become a mature company. What does that mean? You now have responsibilities. You have cash flows. And then comes the day you've been avoiding all your life. You go into decline. Now you have two choices. You can become one of the walking dead. Show that I fell in love with last summer. Don't ask me why. But every time I kept walking by the fence, my son was watching it. And all I could hear was screaming and screeching and squealing. And I said, what the heck is going on? And it's this weird fascination, the show. Because blood comes out of every person. This, you know, all kinds of things happen. So if you've never seen the show, great corporate finance show to watch. Every time I watch The Walking Dead, I see Yahoo. Yeah, because it's in a sense, you know. So essentially, you're still walking, but I'm not sure you should be. So that's the life cycle, and it's amazing how much of corporate finance you can use the life cycle to explain. So I'm going to end today's session, actually, by using the Microsoft and the Snapchat examples. Where does Microsoft fall in this life cycle? It's mature, bordering on. He said, please God, let that decline be far away. As long as Windows and Office keep going, mature, right? Not quite in decline, but let's call it really mature. Now, where do you think Snapchat falls in this life cycle? It's like a baby. It's like a toddler, maybe in diapers. Maybe that's why it makes such messes. Eh? Let's do corporate finance 101. Remember those three big principles, the investment, the financing, and the dividend principle? You guys are going to run Microsoft, and I'm going to ask you about each of these. How much time should Microsoft spend on investment decisions? What did I say the history was for the last 30 years? Every time they did make an investment decision, what have they done to me as a stockholder? They made me poorer 3 years later, right? So my suggestion to you is stop thinking about investments. That surface, retire it. Let it go. You think, but the future is so bleak. It's going to be bleak anyway. Why spend your way into bleakness? So, not much time in investing. Can they afford to borrow a lot of money? Sure, they have two cash cows, Windows and Office. They can afford to borrow a lot of money. Can they afford to pay a lot in dividends? Yeah, what other use do they have for it? Especially since I took the investment responsibility off your shoulders. Might as well give it all back. So for Microsoft, very little time in the investment decision because it doesn't seem to be doing anything productive here other than creating lost value. Borrow a lot, pay a great deal in dividends. So if you want to buy back stock, I'm okay with that too. Now let's go to Snapchat. Is the investment decision a big deal for you? What is it? It's going to have to convert the 30 million users into cash flows. It's huge. In fact, it's the only thing you should really be thinking about. How do I convert these users and coming up with creative ways of doing it? How much money can you borrow? Don't think too long. Go with your gut. You borrow, what happens? You have a loan. Once you have a loan, what do you have to make payments on? But make interest payments, right? What's the problem with that? You don't have any money. You could go to the bank and say, I have a lot of promise and potential. But unless the bank is really stupid, he's going to say, I need some cash. So don't borrow money. It's going to be asking for trouble. In fact, when I was in India last week, I was doing a session for the CFA for CFA Asia. And I was talking about Flipkart. Flipkart is one of these rising Indian online retail companies. A lot of promise and potential. But towards the end of last year, they borrowed money. And I said, I don't understand this. Why would you borrow money? I still don't understand it. Nobody there explained it to me. But how much can you afford to pay in dividends? Again, go with your gut. What dividends? You're probably going to be raising new equity. So for you, it's all investing, no borrowing, no dividends. We're done. You tell me where you are in the life cycle. I can essentially map out what you should be focusing on in corporate finance. Early in your life cycle, it's all investing. As you age, you start thinking about the financing decision. Why? Because as long as you're making 50% returns on your projects, what does it matter if your cost of capital is 12, 14, or 15%? You don't care. As those returns start to come down, you say, maybe I can find a better mix of debt and equity. Maybe I can lower my hurdle rate and my cost of capital. In fact, one of the giveaways that a company is aging is when it starts to spend more money on how much to borrow and what the financing decision should be. And one of the signs you're getting into decline is of all your time is about how much cash should I return and when should I return it. The life cycle is going to be something you're going to see over and over again in this class, kind of return. Every time I introduce an aspect of corporate finance, I'm going to bring up the life cycle. And any time I talk about a company, I'm going to talk about where it is in the life cycle because I think it will explain a lot of what you see in that company. So I think we're done for today. I hope I didn't freak you out too much. But I will see you on Wednesday. Well, you have a Stern address, email address too. Find out what it is because you'll need it for other stuff. Okay. So go to the sixth floor. Okay. Because the minute you register in a Stern class, you're also given a Stern email address. Okay.
Should I email you that email
then? Once you get the Stern email address, then forward all the Stern email. Anything you get sent to the Stern email to you. The reason you need the Stern email address, though, is for things like access to Bloomberg's. You will need the Stern email address.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually one of the students at Stern, so I've been getting your emails.
So go to the sixth floor. Anytime you register in the Stern class, you get a Stern email address as well.
Okay.
The reason I wanted to get that is there's some stuff at Stern that you will not be able to access without a Stern email address.
Okay. I have that.
Once you get the Stern email address, just set it up to forward all the emails to your address.
Okay.
Because I can add your address to the Gmail, the Google, but But it's not that it's tough for me, but then you won't be able to do all the rest of the stuff. So I'd like you to have the sturdy mail address.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
Jared.
Hi.
I was just like, so like I was like recruiting last semester for like banking and stuff. So I just was like thinking from an interest valuation perspective, like when you mentioned hurdle rates and like snap nature, how is that reflected like in a, when you're like a company thing like Beta? Is that kind of like the same thing? Cause it's also
From the other side. Right?
It's from the other side. But it's like the same term, like, or it's
same
like
term.
Two different things.
It's exactly the same thing. When you talk about cost of capital in corporate finance,
uh-huh.
Same cost of capital, you're doing valuation.
And then, like, when you were talking, like, you were saying, like, you want to quantify, like, you can quantify every strategic
you have
like,
to.
Opportunity.
You have no choice.
So when you're creating, like, a merger analysis and you're, like, putting in, like, revenue and cost synergies, like, in terms, like, on the actual analysis, does that mean, like, you personally would, like, go in depth and really understand, like, how
you have to. You're telling people to pay that money. You better do that. Otherwise, you're telling people to pay for nothing.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
Nice to meet you. My name is Chika.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask a quick question about financial calculators versus normal scientific calculators. Do you think I can
get a financial calculator simply because of PV function? It's not the big issue. If you get a scientific calculator, get a programmable one at least. If you get a programmable one, it's okay.
Okay.
But get a cheap financial calculator because I think the PV button will save you some time.
Of course. All right. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Hey, how are you?
I just had a question that you mentioned with CFA Asia. There was something I was talking to my parents about CFA. I mentioned you can't actually take advantage of CFA.